What is up, everybody? This is Jim Mylock, and you're listening to Pot of Fame, the podcast where we break down the careers of former athletes and decide whether or not you should get a call to the Hall. Ladies and gentlemen, today we have another Pot of Fame book club episode. We have author Adam Lazarus coming on the podcast to talk about his latest book, The Wingman, The Unlikely, Unusual, Unbreakable Friendship between John Glenn and Ted Williams. And yes, I said unusual, extremely weird there, so I apologize. The Unlikely, Unusual, Unbreakable Friendship, that's 3 years in a row, it's a lot, between John Glenn and Ted Williams. So this book came back out, this book came out back in August. I got through it in a weekend. I did not know much about John Glenn going into this book. I knew plenty about Ted Williams, and this book covers both of their lives and then how their lives intersected during the Korean War, since they fought alongside each other, something I did not know. And then their lives, you know, 50 years post-war, what happened with both of them, and their lives intersect quite a bit following the war. And again, both of these guys in different ways, you know, American heroes. Ted Williams, one of the best baseball players of all time. Of course, first ballot Hall of Famer. And then John Glenn, I would say one of the more famous civil servants in U.S. history and a astronaut Hall of Famer. Did not know there's an astronaut Hall of Fame. There very much is. I can't confirm that John Glenn was a first ballot guy, but he got in back in 1990. I assume he had to be first ballot, if that's even a thing there. I am not well versed in that Hall of Fame, but again, he's an astronaut Hall of Famer. Ted Williams, of course, baseball Hall of Famer. And Adam and I just really had a really great conversation about both of these very important men in U.S. history, everything they brought to the table. And again, we talk about all of this in the context of he has this book out now, and it's really worth a read. Whether you're a baseball fan, a U.S. history fan, if you're a fan of both, you're really going to like this. But I had a lot of fun reading Adam's latest work, and I really enjoyed our conversation as well. So this is Pot of Fame Book Club. With the quick facts out of the way, let's bring on Adam. All right. So I'd like to welcome to the podcast today, author Adam Lazarus. Adam, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. So Adam, we are talking about your latest book, The Wingman, The Unlikely, Unusual, Unbreakable Friendship between John Glenn and Ted Williams, that came out back in August of this year. And Adam, I got to tell you, I couldn't have enjoyed your book much more. Again, as the title says, it's not a spoiler alert here. The book is about both Ted Williams and John Glenn. It's about their life as individuals, how their lives intersected during the Korean War, and then their lifelong friendship after that, even though, and we'll probably talk about this, very different people. They had some similarities, but very different people, but still were able to have a lifelong friendship. And again, the book covers all of this. And first question, you probably get this all the time, but I got to ask it. How did this book come to be? What was the lightning bolt that was like, I got to write this book. I got to tell this story.
Well, we're actually coming up on Veterans Day. It's early November every year. And I was on Twitter, somewhere, Facebook, maybe looking at just scrolling, you know, doom scrolling, like they call it. And one of the photos that one of the accounts I follow has old baseball photos, baseball history, you know, Willie Mays or Joe DiMaggio or Johnny Bench or whoever. And just because it was Veterans Day, they posted something like, did you know that John Glenn and Ted Williams served together in the Korean War? And there was a photo of them together during the Korean War. And I know a lot about Ted Williams. I am a baseball history nut. I'm not from Massachusetts or a Red Sox fan or anything like that, but I grew up in a baseball history family. We used to visit Cooperstown every year. So I knew all about Ted Williams in 406 and the home run in the All-Star game. And I was a big fan of all his records and achievements. And conversely, I'm from Ohio. And so you don't grow up in Ohio and not know who John Glenn is. And I knew him from The Right Stuff. I knew about his achievements in being an astronaut, being a senator. And I knew a lot of, I feel like I knew a lot about both these men. And then I saw this photo and I had absolutely no idea. I was kind of surprised that it wasn't something that you learn early on when you study these guys. And the first thing I did was I pulled Ted Williams' autobiography off my bookshelf, which I had had since I was a kid. And it's sure enough, he mentions his service with John Glenn. He mentions getting letters from John Glenn when he was in the hospital, getting neck surgery late in his career, telling him that John Glenn had been selected for the NASA program. So I learned more and more about it. And I was just amazed that I had no idea about this connection. And certainly a lot of other people that I've encountered along the course of this book didn't know it either. So the more and more I was curious about it, the more I read about this friendship, and not just that they served together in the Korean War, but that it spanned many, many decades.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you right now, I had no idea they knew each other. And embarrassingly enough, I know plenty about Ted Williams. Did not know much about John Glenn going into this book. So basically everything I know about John Glenn, other than, and again, this is really embarrassing for me to admit, but I'll be honest here, because I feel like I know a good amount about history. I obviously know about a lot about sports, but I didn't know who John Glenn really was or even look into it until that movie Hidden Figures came out and he was in that movie. Like that was when I was like, I was asking my parents, like, John Glenn, like, I know Neil Armstrong, I know Buzz. They're like, John Glenn was like the biggest deal when we were growing up. And this was someone just not in my, I'm not from Ohio, I'm from Chicago, but just not a guy I know. And as I read this book, as I read your book and I learned more and more about it, I was like, how did I not know more about this guy? I would say one of the most famous Americans probably of the 20th century. But I do want to talk about Ted Williams first, and then I want to jump to Glenn for a bit. So your book, and again, just like you, Adam, baseball, history, love it. Know so much about Ted Williams, of course. And the one thing your book reminded me of the whole time was just like how mythical Ted Williams, I feel like, seems. Like, he commanded respect from everyone. When Ted Williams was coming, whispers are going off. People are trying to get like a view of him. When he came to that 1999 All-Star game, I was only 9 years old at the time. And I remember knowing how big of a deal that was and seeing all the players I loved playing looked at him like he was a god. Like he was a god, almost like a folk hero. And I don't know if Ted Williams, I mean, there's a case, like, I don't know if he's the best baseball player of all time, but when I think of like how I looked at like Bill Russell when he comes to basketball games, or like Jim Brown, or even Michael Jordan, my idol, to me, they didn't have that same like almost like folk hero type, like almost you couldn't believe you were seeing him in person. I guess what makes Ted Williams so like almost like a folk hero, this like almost mystical man? What about Ted Williams makes him this? Because I don't think there's been an other athlete, and I'm sure people would push me on that, but like Ted Williams in that regard. And I don't know if we'll ever look at an athlete like that, quite like that again.
I think there's a variety of reasons why Ted Williams had this sort of Paul Bunyan kind of appeal. For one, because, you know, all the guys you mentioned, even Bill Russell, Williams was from an earlier generation than that. And sure, Williams' rookie year was 1939. His first year in the league was Lou Gehrig's last year in Major League Baseball. So I think there's some sort of element of him playing in the ancient times and him to have survived. But I think you mentioned all the active players in 1999 crowding around him. The people who sought advice from him, you know, he talked to Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa that day, I remember, and I'm sure they picked his brain. He's famous for, you know, he met with, he's good friends with Tony Gwynn. He helped Rod. He talked with hitting with Rod Carew. If he was alive today, he would have talked, you know, even 10 years ago, he would have talked hitting with Ichiro or whoever. I think there's something about baseball that translates across the decades that doesn't maybe have the same modern day sensibilities as basketball or football do. I think hitting a baseball is always hitting a baseball. Football's changed, basketball's changed, hockey's changed, tennis has changed, but it's still, you know, you against the pitcher hitting a baseball. So I think people looked at Ted Williams and all of his achievements as a major league star and the last man to hit 400 and 500 home runs and two triple crowns. And I think they still respected his achievements, even though they happened, you know, 30 years before a lot of these guys were even born. So I think that's part of it. Also, his personality was larger than life. He was loud and boisterous, and he filled up any room he walked into, and people stopped if he was in the room. And it was just, he had a draw, a magnetism about him. It didn't really endear him to his family. He was married and divorced three times. He didn't have great relations with his children. But I think in the baseball community, and really to anybody who was a sports fan, there was a magnetism about him that people recognized. And just the last thing, you know, you talk about the quote unquote mythical element of Ted Williams. I don't know if a lot of people would explicitly say this or even realize it, but it draws back to what my book is sort of half about, his service in the wars. He missed 5 years of service, three in World War II, and for the most part, two during the Korean War, which is really the focus of this book. So, you know, he did everything he did, 521 home runs, the highest batting average of anyone born in the 20th century, two triple crowns. He should have won three, missed out on a third by mere percentage points, considered the greatest hitter of all time, but he didn't get to 3,000 hits and he didn't get to 700 home runs because he missed 5 years of service. And I think for a lot of people, that's kind of the thing about Ted Williams. Look at everything he did and he missed 5 years, 5 years of his prime. I mean, I like to compare it to if LeBron James or Brady or someone like that had been pulled out of service today, it would have been sort of at the end of their career where, you know, maybe they weren't in their high point anymore. Ted Williams missed like 25, 26, 27, and 33 and 34 in his years. And I think for a lot of people, that what if is what really enhances the Ted Williams legacy.
I'm really glad you brought that up because that was one of my questions today. You know, again, as you said, missed almost 5 years, you know, World War II from 43, 45, missed those three full seasons and then missed most of 52 and 53, yet still is a member, right, of the 500 home run club. Still almost had 2,000 RBIs, which is just remarkable because, again, he lost those prime seasons. Adam, my question to you here is, if those wars don't happen, or if Ted Williams doesn't serve, either or, and he has those five full years, and he plays the rest of his career the way he did, do you think we look at Ted Williams as the best baseball player in history? Because right now, when I'm thinking of I think baseball is hard. Who's the GOAT, right? Babe Ruth comes to mind. Willie Mays comes to mind. Hank Aaron's in there. Ted Williams is in there, but I don't think there's too many people that are like, he is the best ever. Some do, some don't. But if he didn't lose those 5 years, do you think he's the definitive greatest baseball player of all time?
No, I don't. I do think even with missing the 5 years, he's the greatest hitter of all time. And I hate to like couch it in those terms. Ted Williams, no. The greatest hitter of all time. I could go on and on and on for reasons of why. But he wasn't a great fielder. He was a fine fielder. He didn't steal bases. The funny thing about Ted Williams is before Barry Bonds came along, he had virtually every walk record. And same thing with Ricky Henderson. He walked more than anybody. And I think it was part of his... Ted Williams was often considered a very selfish player. I don't know if that's fair or not. He walked a lot. He famously didn't alter his swing to avoid the Williams shift in the 1946 World Series and didn't play very well. So I think it's fair to say he was a very kind of selfish player. He cared about hits. I don't know if you would consider him the same kind of competitor that Willie Mays or Derek Jeter or one of those guys was. So I think it's hard given that to consider him the greatest player of all time. I always think that Babe Ruth is the greatest baseball player of all time because of his abilities as a pitcher in addition to his hitting. I think Willie Mays was the greatest all-around position player because of his everything he achieved at the plate, and he stole bases, and he was arguably the greatest defensive center fielder of all time. But yeah, Williams was, we would say, a one-dimensional player, but that one dimension was probably the greatest in the history of the game. So no matter, even if he had gotten to 720 home runs and 2,300 RBIs and won six MVPs, I still don't think you consider him the greatest player in history just because his skills were at the plate. And also, fair or not, you can't discount the fact that he never won a World Series.
Yep.
All the others that I've mentioned, Ruth, Garrett, DiMaggio, Berra, Mays, Aaron, today, I don't know who you would choose, but Mike Schmidt or Cal Ripken, they all won World Series. Ted Williams played in one World Series, didn't play very well. I think he hit 200 or 210. I don't think he had any extra base hits either. The Red Sox lost. Now, the failures of the Red Sox are documented very finely in the 20th century, so I don't think you can really blame Williams for that. But if you're going to be considered the greatest of all time, I think you have to win a World Series. And just to cross sports, I mean, Dan Marino very well may have been the greatest quarterback of all time. I think you could say of the thrower of the football, I think there's a case to be made Dan Marino was the greatest quarterback of all time. He never won a Super Bowl, so he's never going to be considered that. So I think all those factors do make Williams, you know, there's a catch to his there's one line on his resume that will never be filled.
No, I think that's exactly right. And again, just going to the hitter thing, and I'm sure my listeners live, you might know this, but it's kind of like when I go look at Babe Ruth's baseball reference, it just cracks me up because the numbers are out of control. But Ted Williams are too. 344 career batting average, 42 lifetime on base. That's the best ever. 634 slugging. I mean, the guy hit 521 home runs while batting 344. You're never going to see that kind of power and content, I mean, hitting ability ever again, especially the way baseball is trending right now. Truly remarkable. And I agree with all the points you made.
The one thing I would add is my book is not a baseball history book.
Nope,
there is plenty of baseball in there, but there is baseball in there. And I go, you know, I was trying, everybody knows about Ted Williams hitting 406, and they know about the thing that's, you know, he did not play well in the World Series in his early days and his friendship with Joe DiMaggio, his rivalry. Not as many, and I didn't know this, especially since it in the years after the war, after his service in Korea, when he suffered, you know, he flew combat missions, he damaged his hearing, had several health issues. In 1957, he's 39 years old. He's, you know, most guys that age are retired. He hit 388. He hit 38 home runs. I think he tied with Mickey Mantle for the home run title. He was walked like he's intentionally walked like 40 times, which Barry Bonds or Don Baylor or someone came along. It was the record for most intentional walks because the Red Sox were not very good. So at 39, he hits 388, had 38 home runs, should have won the MVP, but they gave it to Mantle. It's just a remarkable, you know, everything about it he achieved when he was 25, hitting 406. But for him to do that at 39, he's still the oldest guy to lead all of baseball in batting average when he did it that year. And then he won the batting title the next year, too. That's for me, and it's something I highlight in the book, his achievements at the end of his career. He had a terrible season in 1959, but then he comes back age 42. I think he hit 28 home runs. Just remarkable. I think so. That's one of the things for the real connoisseurs of baseball history who know a lot about Ted Williams. That's the thing that I like to focus on.
So, and let's go here. Let's say it's 50 years from now. Okay. You're talking to your grandkids or I don't know, maybe local kids in the neighborhood. And you're talking to them about Ted Williams. Cause they're like, hey, he wrote a book, you know, 50 years ago about Ted. What are those kids going to have the most trouble believing? I got three of them here for you. Are they going to have are they going to have the most trouble believing Ted Williams hit 406 in 1941? Mm-hmm. Are they going to have trouble believing that Ted Williams only won two MVP awards? Because I think that still baffles me to this day. Or is the thing that's going to shock them the most, or they're going to have trouble believing the most, is that one of the greatest athletes in the world went to go fight in two separate wars during the prime of their career?
First of all, I'm just glad you didn't mention his freezing of his body
I didn't want to do that. That's not
honestly, no, I'm just saying if I was talking to kids in the neighborhood in 50 years and they had stuff Wikipedia or whatever, that would probably be the thing. You know, if you mentioned Baseball Reference, I believe if you go on Baseball Reference and you look at guys who've died, it all says like buried in Oak Park Cemetery or buried in whatever, and it says frozen for Ted Williams.
It does. It says, I have it up right here, buried, yeah. Frozen. I've never seen that. That's so incredible.
Just glad. I mean, I could talk about that at length. I do bring that up in the book, but to get to the real, you know, useful question that you asked, I just think, yes, the MVPs, he should have won more. He did not get along with sports writers. And that's a good reason why he didn't get along with it. He didn't win more MVPs. He really should have won five MVPs, if nothing else, four. the war element, yes, I think it's unfathomable today, especially since we don't have a draft anymore. But I guess people could look back and they realize it wasn't, Ted Williams was not the only player to serve, certainly in World War II. Joe DiMaggio, Bob Feller, Warren Spahn, those guys, Stan Musial, in some capacity, they were all pulled out of baseball to serve. Whether or not they served in the war and combat is another story. And even in Korea, guys missed. There was actually a guy in the squadron next to Ted Williams who played for the Cincinnati Reds. So he missed time. There weren't a lot of guys, but there were some. So I think, yes, that's unbelievable. I just think no one's going to hit 400 again. And the reasons why, I think the Luis, what's his name for the
Alvarez,
Marlins?
Alvarez, yeah.
Hitting like 400 in May. And I remember seeing an article that was like, could he be the 400 hitter? And I just laughed at that because sure, a guy could have been hitting 400 at the All-Star break. I think John Olerud hit 400 at the All-Star break 1 year.
He did. We just talked about John Olerud. It's actually this week's episode is about John Olerud. Underrated, great hitter.
I remember. Great hitter. He wasn't Ted Williams, but he was a great hitter. I mean, even Tony Gwynn, the year he hit 394, I think that the season ended on August 13th, right? So he had six more weeks. You know, yeah, he could have hit 410 and gotten to 400. I think it was much more likely he was going to drop down. The year Brett hit 390, he missed a huge chunk of the season. He didn't play late at the end either, I think. Same thing with Carew. I don't think Carew ever really flirted with hitting
300. He had 381, I think, 1 year, I want to say.
But I just think it's the same thing with DiMaggio's streak. If somebody got to 35 games with DiMaggio's streak, the pressure would – anybody would crumble. It's just the odd. It's not just the impossibility of doing it. Just the pressure. They would crumble, I think. And maybe they don't go hitless. Maybe, you know, for Ted Williams, some guy hitting 400 in mid-September, I don't think necessarily is going to go on an 0-for-30 streak. But I just don't see anybody surviving the way he did. You know, the famous story about Ted Williams is he was hitting 399 on the last day of the regular season. And they said, if you sit out, it'll round up to 400. And he said, I'm not going to sit out. And he had a doubleheader and he got six hits and eight at bats and it went up to 406. First of all, no one would do that today. I think somebody would sit out. So I think it's just a marvel of baseball history that he did that in the modern era. And I don't think anybody else is going to do it.
Yeah. Especially the way baseball is played today is much different than back then too. But as you said, we get excited when someone's flirting with it, when there's 4 months of baseball left. Like it's just not going to happen. The pressure would get to you in today's, you know, modern society. It's Ted didn't have to deal with Twitter, I guess, and stuff like that. But I don't know if that would have
go with I was watching the World Series in-game interviews, you know?
Yeah, like, I know. It's nuts. He would have hated that. Oh my God. He would have hated that. All right, Adam, I want to switch over to John Glenn for a little bit, because again, this is someone I didn't know much about going into the book, and I'm so glad I read your book because I'm so much better informed now. And he accomplished so much in his career, and something you wrote about in your book, which, you know, made me, I think, understand the magnitude of John Glenn, was that Ted Williams like looked up to him in awe. And again, I spoke earlier, right? Like Ted Williams is like mythical guy. Everyone treats him like a god. But even Ted Williams was like, this is my hero. Like John Glenn is my hero. And again, Glenn accomplished so much in his career, you know, fire pilot in World War II, Chinese Civil War, Korean War, first supersonic transcontinental flight, first American to orbit the Earth, flew in space when he was 77, was a senator for many years in Ohio, did all these great things. What stands out to you, though, is the most impressive part of John Glenn's just extremely impressive life?
It's something that is not, you probably won't find on his Wikipedia page. John Glenn began learning how to fly. He loved pilots. He grew up at a time when, you know, it was like 20 years after the Wright brothers invented the airplane was when he was born. So airplanes were new and amazing. And his dad took him up for a flight one day when he was 5 years old. They paid some guy who had an airplane to take him up. He loved building model airplanes. He was a kid when Charles Lindbergh made his famous transatlantic flight. So he was obsessed with flying from a very young age. And when he was in college, he went and studied to get his civilian pilot's license. This is 1941, right before Pearl Harbor and World War II breaks out. So even before that, he was getting his experience to learn to be a pilot. And that was, so he gets his pilot's license in June of 1941. And he doesn't stop flying until 2012, when he's 91 years old. He flew his own plane. He, you know, he flew in World War II. He flew in the Marine Corps after World War II. Flies in the Korean War as both Marine and then later on a temporary assignment with the Air Force. Then becomes a NASA test, a Navy test pilot, experimenting, flying experimental planes. Then completes the first supersonic transatlantic flight in history, that which he basically devised the idea and planned it out himself. He didn't just, they didn't just tell him to get in a plane and go fly. It was all his idea. Then he goes into NASA and is conducts the most important Mercury mission, flying three times around the Earth. Then he sort of retires from that and becomes a senator, but he continues to fly. He flew himself across the country when he was a senator. He flew from his home to Ohio to a place where he lived in Maryland when he was serving in the Senate, and then back and forth every weekend. And even when he retired, he continued to do that. He gave up flying at age 91. To me, the idea of a guy flying an airplane, I mean, I don't like to be on the road with people who look to be in that era, you know, that age. But John Glenn was piloting an aircraft regularly until he was 91 years old. That's the most remarkable thing about, to me, is about John Glenn, his 70 years of piloting. That's just, to me, it's an achievement I can't even fathom.
No, that is, I wasn't even thinking about that. That is mighty impressive. And I know my grandparents, as they got in the 80s, we started talking about getting that. And that is on the road, not in the air. So yes. I love that you picked that one, and that's great. One more question about John Glenn for you. You know, he ran for president in 1984. I definitely wasn't aware of that going into this book. Obviously, he did not win. What do you think a John Glenn presidency would have looked like? Do you think he would have been a successful president?
I think it would have been very interesting. I think he would have been a great candidate. He ran in the Democratic primary in 1984 when Reagan was the sitting president and everybody was trying to, the Democrats were trying to unseat Reagan. And it turned out that Walter Mondale, who got the Democratic nomination, was the biggest blowout in presidential history, losing to Reagan in his reelection in 1984. So I think he would have done better than that. I also think he would have had a very good chance of winning the presidency, but given his status, his name recognition. He was not a very good politician, though. And that's something that the book sort of covers. I think it's why he didn't ever become president. How he would have been as president, I think he would have been probably not a very charismatic speaker, not a very inspirational leader. I interviewed a lot of the people who worked on his campaign. I think he did not do the right things to become president or act presidential necessarily. The way we look at it today, which is, you know, all the flashy and substance and campaign promises, he would have been very pragmatic. I think he probably would have done a great job on a lot of issues, particularly defense. And that was still the Cold War. All the things of boosting the military, certainly getting NASA back on track after the Challenger episode and a lot of other problems that NASA had had. So I think in those terms, he probably would have been a very successful president, but he would not have been necessarily a memorable president. I don't think he had that shot in his bag. He wasn't a good public speaker. He was monotone, and in some ways, not to pick on him, but a lot of people thought he was boring and tedious the way he talked and the things he said. I think he would not have been remembered as as a Kennedy or a Bill Clinton or, you know, whoever you want to choose that was a very inspirational person. But he certainly, you know, that was one of the things that I looked at when I wrote about Glenn's run for the presidency in 1984 was one of his campaign advisors told me this. He had, you know, great respect for Glenn, but he said something sort of offhand that after everything Glenn had achieved, particularly in the military, serving in two wars, 24 years in the Marine Corps, senator for two terms, that he thought Glenn looked at it that sort of like it was now his turn. He had achieved the rank of president. It was, you know, the next natural progression for him was to become president. And I think that kind of stuck with me that Glenn, on paper, sure, he probably would have been a good president for everything that he had achieved in his career. But that's not really how it works. And I don't think Glenn ever really came to grips with that. So for a lot of reasons, I don't think a Glenn presidency would have been something that we look at today, like, oh, what could have been? I'm sure he would have done a fine job. I don't think he would have gotten us into any wars or anything like that. But I do think it's one of those things where I don't like to assume that just because Glenn was president, this country would have been in so many different directions. It's like, I always watch like a football game, and when a team misses a field goal in the first quarter and then they lose by 3 points, that doesn't necessarily mean if they'd made that field goal, they would have tied the game. You know what I mean? I don't think Glenn would have been some kind of transcendent figure in the history of our presidents.
All right, my last question, and this is by far my toughest one. This is not a fair question at all, but I'm going to ask you anyway. So, at the beginning, I was talking like John Glenn, Ted Williams. These are icons, heroes of the 20th century, both from, you know, Ted Williams played baseball, the American pastime at the time, at one of the highest levels we've ever seen, and then serving the military all these times. John Glenn, his whole life was dedicated to public service, military, political, space, everything here. I'm a big, like, if you're on Twitter and my listeners know this, I talk about Rushmores all the time, like Rushmores of best Bears quarterbacks. I'll do one for anything. And this is a much bigger one I'm going to ask you. Let's say it's 1999. So now we're going back in time. I made you go 50 years ahead. Now we're going back. 1999, North Dakota is getting sick of South Dakota getting all the love for Mount Rushmore. And they're like, we're going to build something before the millennium. And we're going to build four faces again into a mountain here. I don't know if there's mountains in North Dakota. I have to assume there is, but they're going to build some mountains, four faces, American heroes of the 20th century. Who represents the 20th century the best? And I'm going to do for this exercise, no presidents are allowed. I don't want us using presidents. They already got the presidents in South. This is going to be just anyone else. So it can be sports, musicians, military, politicians, mixes. Because when I was thinking about this, I was like, John Glenn and Ted Williams, like, they really captured America throughout the 20th century quite well with all their exploits. I don't know if they necessarily are guaranteed a spot on this mountain, but I think they would really have a good chance at making it on this mountain. And while I give you maybe 30 seconds to collect your thoughts, because I'm throwing this out of left field, I just started making a list of names to maybe generate something on your end. So while you're thinking, these are some of the names I jotted down, not necessarily I would put on there, but, you know, I have John Glenn and Ted Williams on there. I have Neil Armstrong on there, Eleanor Roosevelt, George Patton, Bill Russell, Jackie Robinson, Billie Jean King, Henry Ford, Martin Luther King, Amelia Earhart, Walt Disney, Louis Armstrong, Babe Ruth, Jim Brown, Michael Jordan, Muhammad Ali, Madonna, and Oprah. So, again, you don't have to use any of those names. It was just to spear some curiosity in your brain. And Adam, there are no wrong answers here, but I'm curious, who would your four be?
I would definitely choose Martin Luther King. I would probably choose, I don't know, I would flip a coin between like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs.
Okay.
I guess. Henry Ford. I mean, if we're going to strip away all the politics involved,
it's just, okay, they're on a mountain. It is for all of America. We know America is very split right now, of course. So half America would like it.
God, I would love to say Ted Williams belongs on there, but I don't think so. I think Jackie Robinson would be a good choice. I know that George Will once said that the most important African-American and Black figure in American history is Martin Luther King, but a close second is Jackie Robinson. So I kind of hate to have to choose that way. But I do think John Glenn deserves a spot on there, because you can talk about all his achievements and what he did from a political standpoint, a patriotic standpoint, a technological standpoint, all the service he did for NASA and expanding aviation. But what I like to think about with John Glenn above everything else is his sense of duty and public service, which duty doesn't have to be the military. For the most part, it was. I think John Glenn gave his gave all he had to this country in terms of public service, from whether it was the military, NASA, the Senate, just philanthropy, all those avenues. I think he's a model for us, today's America, where I don't want to get on a soapbox. I mean, I'm not like that. I'm not that old. I'm 41. So I don't want to talk negative about this upcoming generation or even my generation. But I do think there's a self-obsession and there is what's in it for me, you know, that I so often hear, like, that's not my problem, that kind of idea. And for John Glenn, that never even entered the equation for him. He was very indicative of his generation that many signed up to serve after Pearl Harbor. And he was the first one to do so. And the same thing with NASA. Like, yeah, maybe they were seeking thrills and they loved piloting, but they thought they were doing something for their country to sit on top of a missile and get launched into space. The same thing, you know, when John Glenn really was 77 and he really wanted to go back to space, he really wanted to because he wanted to go back to space, but he also thought it was good for a lot of reasons. It was good for the science they did behind it. He thought it was a good inspiration for his generation, for senior citizens to, you know, I'm 77, but I'm not in a retirement home sitting on a couch. I'm still doing things. And I think that's what I take away from John Glenn is his devotion to the whole, to the public. And he felt he had a responsibility. I remember I interviewed John Glenn's daughter, Lynn, and she had many great stories. And one of them was he was in the Senate outside the Capitol building and signing autographs. And one of his staffers was like, "You have to leave now. There's a vote going on right now." And the staffer was dragging, like pulling him away, and people were signing one of the autographs. And there was one person, he was like, "Stay here. I promise you I will be back. I promise I have to go do this vote. I promise you I will be back." And I'm sure most of them left thinking he wasn't going to come back. But then you see him, I guess, sprinting out of the Capitol building 10 or 20 minutes later to go back. And, you know, this is a 70-year-old guy or whatever, to sign more autographs. And there were people there. He was true to his word. So I think that's, if you're going to choose figures like that, you can't choose a better figure than John Glenn.
Adam, I think that's a great way to wrap this up. Thank you so much for coming on and talk about your latest book. Before we get you out of here, I know you got some events coming up for the book. Do you want to tell the listeners where to find the book, what you're going to be doing, all that good stuff?
Yeah, the best place to go is just my website, which is adamlazarusbooks.com, L-A-Z-A-R-U-S books.com. I'm actually coming through Ohio and Pennsylvania, November 15th through the 18th. I'll be at Ohio State University on November 15th. I'll be in Pittsburgh on the North Shore, not far from where the Pitt Panthers are playing Boston College that night. The next day, I'll be in Pepper Pike, Ohio, which is a suburb of Cleveland. And then on that Saturday, the 18th, I'll be at Cincinnati's Books by the Banks Festival in Cincinnati. All the details are just on my website, adamlazarusbooks.com. There's links there for how you can buy the book, and my email address is on there. My publicist, anybody who wants to reach out to me and learn more, I'd be happy to send a signed book plate for them if they buy the book. So yeah, just reach out to me on there.
Everyone, go to Adam's website, buy this book. If you know a little about Ted Williams and John Glenn, a lot, it doesn't matter. It's a great book. It's a great read. I really enjoyed it. And Adam, I enjoyed you coming on and answering some of my impossible questions I threw your way. So really appreciate it. You know, good luck with the tour. Be safe. And hopefully find a reason to get you back on this pod down the road.
Absolutely. And we'll start the funding on that monument in South Dakota.
Exactly. North Dakota. They need something. All right. Take care, Adam. 1st, I want to thank Adam again for coming on the podcast to talk about, again, his latest book, The Wingman, The Unlikely, Unusual, Unbreakable Friendship Between John Glenn and Ted Williams. That is all we have for you today. If you don't already, please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Pod of Fame. If you've done all that, you have done your homework. We will talk to you on Friday. Take care.